Hello and welcome to OMFIF Podcast, a weekly discussion on key trends in investment and economic policy from some of the world's leading commentators. On this week's episode, we examine politics in the Middle East. The Arab Gulf monarchies are playing an increasingly prominent public and international role in the politics and society. During the podcast, we will discuss the political structure and dynamics of the Gulf Cooperation Council states, Saudi Arabia, Oman, Bahrain, Qatar, Kuwait, and United Arab Emirates. My name is Julia Demidova, and I'm pleased to be joined by Christian Ulriksen. Christian is a fellow for Middle East at Rice University's Baker Institute. Previously, Christian worked as a senior Gulf analyst at the Gulf Center for Strategic Studies between 2006 and 2008, and as a co-director at the Kuwait Program on Development, Governance, and Globalization in the Gulf State at the London School of Economics from 2008 until 2013. Christian's country expertise are on Kuwait, Bahrain, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates. Nevertheless, we can explore beyond, and Saudi Arabia will perhaps play a significant role in today's discussion. You have also published a number of books, The First World War in the Middle East, which was published in 2014, Qatar and the Arab Spring, and The Gulf States in International Political Economy. Christian, welcome. To begin with, you could introduce yourself more in context.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be part of the podcast. My work looks at the changing role of the Gulf states in regional and international politics, how three of the Gulf states, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and Qatar, have become much more assertive and even interventionist in some cases, and much more driven in terms of trying to secure regional policy objectives after the turmoil of the Arab Spring in 2011. We've seen the Gulf states take the lead in really trying to reshape, or at least to sort of influence the directions of change in the post-Arab Spring countries that experienced a political transition in 2011. And of course, they haven't done so in the same direction. You've had this big split between Qatar on the one side and Saudi Arabia, the UAE, on the other. And so we see a whole range of issues, Yemen being perhaps the most obvious right now, but also Egypt and Libya, where the Gulf states have really intervened, but without necessarily having a sort of end game in sight as to what they want to achieve.
Fantastic. Maybe we can start with a breaking piece of news, the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. What is going through your mind when you watch this story unfold?
I think the story has been compounded for the Saudis by the fact that they've been unable to present a coherent or a cohesive alternative explanation for what's happened to Jamal. From the beginning, they've been reacting to the story, and their own story has been shifting constantly, and it hasn't given a strong impression, for shall we say. Obviously, this has become a huge flashpoint in Saudi Arabia's international image. I suspect that the ruling elite, or whoever may have sanctioned the action to seize or even kill Jamal Khashoggi, did not foresee such a development, perhaps because they had seen the Trump administration and President Trump himself launch so many attacks on journalists over the past year and a half. They may have thought that one more journalist gone missing wouldn't have caused a reaction. I think the miscalculation was that Jamal was known and liked by many people in Washington, D.C. He was a nameless, faceless activist that people would read about having been detained that they'd never met. So large swathes of the foreign policy establishment in Washington have taken this extremely personally. It's as if one of their friends has been brutally murdered, which in fact it is. So the Saudis did not seem to take that into account in terms of kind of triggering the absolute outrage from both sides of the political aisle. The other main thing I think to point out is that this is, of course, the biggest challenge the Saudis have faced since 9/11. But with 9/11, there was always a degree of consensus in the political and intelligence community that 9/11 was not directed by the Saudi royal family, or there was no government involvement. That was more or less accepted, and the 28 pages that were finally released last year effectively bore that out. With the Jamal Khashoggi story, of course, the impression has been the exact opposite, that this has been an operation directed by people very close to the leadership in Saudi Arabia, even if it hasn't yet been proven. And so the culpability aspect, the fact that this seems to go right to the very top, is going to dominate headlines, I think, for some time to come, particularly as the Washington Post and the New York Times are not going to let this go. Neither, it seems, will politicians, at least in Congress, if not in the White House.
To play the devil's advocate here, the young crown prince arrested a good part of Saudi's business elite, which made him some big enemies. The murder of Jamal Khashoggi, was it an act of patriotism? In other words, a plotted scheme by regime, or an act committed by enemies to destabilize the fragile infrastructure that is being built by the crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman?
What I think made Jamal Khashoggi such a threat to the Saudi leadership was that he was probably the highest profile and best connected, shall we say, dissident, although he wasn't really a dissident. Jamal himself was patriotic, and he thought what he was doing was constructive criticism to correct a series of decisions that he saw taking Saudi Arabia down a very dark path. But he was, of course, based in Washington. He was given a platform in the Washington Post, which gave him an extremely wide voice, and that made him a huge threat to the image that Mohammed bin Salman and the people around him were trying to put together, especially in Washington, where the Trump administration had been the focus of so much Saudi investment in terms of trying to influence. So Jamal's location and voice made him such a counter-narrative to the one that the Saudi government was pushing that it seems that they decided to at least to silence him, whether or not that meant just returning him to the kingdom or, in fact, doing what they may have done to him, is a moot point. He was a voice that provided a credible counter-narrative based upon decades of experience that he could then draw upon to kind of boost his points. For example, he would unpack Mohammed bin Salman's claim that he was returning Saudi Arabia to a moderate form of Islam. And his view of kind of extremism began in 1979. And Jamal would say, well, actually, I grew up in the 70s in Saudi Arabia. It was not moderate then. So, I mean, that sort of counter-narrative was extremely damaging to the royal elite. And so that made Jamal such a threat to them.
What would be the Western actions towards the kingdom or Jamal Khashoggi affair is absolutely irrelevant, and Western relationships with Saudi Arabia evolve beyond this, and economic and geopolitical relationships are more important. And in addition to that, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia has been a good ally to the Western nations over many decades because of the mutual cooperation and trust on the security arena.
Yeah, Saudi Arabia is technically a partner, not an ally. In a sense, there's no treaty of alliance. Although, as you say, there's a whole host of political, economic, security and military agreements that bind Saudi Arabia and the West. The relationship will endure. I suspect a lot of what may happen will perhaps be decided upon whether or not the Crown Prince is either reined in, perhaps with the appointment of a more experienced deputy, or removed altogether, although I don't see that as a possibility, at least right now. But I think Western governments will be looking to see that there's a degree of pragmatism that is restored to policy making. There's been a whole host of highly sort of unexpected decisions over the past year and a half since he became Crown Prince that's given investors and political risk and kind of partners pause for thought. The arrest of the Ritz-Carlton last November, the blockade of Qatar, the war in Yemen, of course, the decision to dramatically cut ties with Canada, and now this, and the detention last year of the Lebanese Prime Minister, Saad Hariri. So this isn't a one-off. This is continuation of a trend, which I think has deeply unnerved investors and partners who have been used to Saudi policymaking being pragmatic and consensual. And up until several years ago, we all complained that policymaking in Saudi Arabia was so slow, and now we complain it's too fast. But of course, one reason why it was so slow is that you had four or five very senior princes whose agreements had to really be secured before policy could be made. And that kind of put in a system of checks and balances to prevent the sort of reckless or unexpected decision making we've seen over the past year. And those checks and balances now have been stripped away. And I think partners will be hoping and trying to see if some of those checks and balances could at least be restored.
Of course, we will come back to some of the questions on Saudi vision and the investment into Saudi Arabia a bit later, but I would like to cover a little bit more of Jamal Khashoggi. Jamal was close to Muslim Brotherhood and the Turkish AK party. Obviously, Turkey is on the other side of the fence, closer to Qatar, Iran, and perhaps Russia. We have witnessed Turkey establishing the military base in Qatar during those early days of blockade. That caused, of course, a lot of frustration from the neighboring countries. What are the economical benefits for Turkey to play against predominantly Saudi Arabia?
Well, I think Turkey perhaps, or Erdogan, President Erdogan perhaps, is maybe trying to take a claim for himself as one of the leaders of the Sunni Arab world. I mean, this is a kind of deeply contentious territory. And given Turkey's historical role in the region and Erdogan's own sort of ambitions, he may be looking to try and supplant the Saudis as at least the sort of moral leader of a large bloc. Now, of course, we have had this geopolitical schism over the past 3 or 4 years, where you have had these sort of Turkey, Qatar, even Iran on one side, Saudi Arabia, UAE, Egypt on the other. Although, I mean, Saudi-Turkish relations were not necessarily as bad, for example, as UAE-Turkey relations. So with the Saudis, there was at least an element of mutual cooperation in the sense that each couldn't do without the other. I think what will be interesting going forward is how much the Turks want to play the Khashoggi affair in terms of extracting concessions or anything else from the Saudis, or whether they're both triangulating their position vis-a-vis the United States. Now, of course, Turkey and the U.S. have had a complicated relationship under the Trump administration, but the release of the pastor a couple of weeks ago could at least signify that the Turks are now trying to triangulate Khashoggi's death with the U.S. more than with the Saudis, or perhaps all with both at once, which may make it even more unpredictable to see what happens.
Indeed, I agree. Turkish relationship to U.S. is a bit difficult at the moment. Do you think there are any dangers and threats from Turkish military expansion across GCC states?
Well, the Turkey-Qatar relationship is quite interesting because the U.S. government, or at least Donald Trump himself, had initially surprised and shocked people in the Gulf, especially in Qatar, when he seemed to side with the Saudis and Emiratis on the second day of the blockade. And that was a real sort of wake-up call for people in the Gulf who had long assumed that if anything happened, the U.S. would be the partner of external security. You know, they would provide that guarantee, as of course it happened in 1990 when Kuwait was invaded by Iraq. And so for the White House and the president, at least temporarily, to change sides was a shock. And the Turks, of course, didn't. And they actually rushed through the ratification of the military agreements, allowed the Turks to station troops in Qatar. And so Turkey has become extremely important, just as a tool, really, of diversifying your security eggs so you don't have them all in one basket. And I think that was the lesson that Qatar and the other small Gulf states, regardless of whether they're on Qatar's side or not, I think that's what they'll take, that especially at a time, or if there's any future time, when you have unpredictable president in the White House, you can't have everything staked on one relationship. You need to diversify. You need to make sure that if one relationship unexpectedly goes sour, you have other options. And so I think from the Qatari point of view, and probably from the other point of view in other Gulf states, that's the lesson. You cannot just rely on the U.S. You've got to have the Turks in the Qatari case. Perhaps the Kuwait has recently invited British troops to be stationed in Kuwait. You know, the Emiratis have a French naval base. They have the Australians in Al Minhad. So I mean, I think that's going to be one of the things going forward. The U.S. will remain, I suspect, the strongest by far security presence in the Gulf, but they won't be the only one.
Indeed, we have seen and witnessed how UAE, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia and Egypt have decided to cut ties with Qatar. Do you think this was Trump's visit that sparked GCC crisis? And who benefits from Qatar isolation? And perhaps we can also cover the importance of the external powers and political influence.
Well, hard to tell exactly what happened behind the scenes of the Riyadh summit, although I would say that the summit was really arranged by the White House and the Royal Court in Saudi Arabia. There wasn't really much involvement, say, of the State Department, for example. So it could have been something that was arranged by Mohammed bin Salman, Mohammed bin Zayed in Abu Dhabi, and people around the president, such as Jared Kushner. The president himself seemed to indicate in his tweets on the second day of the blockade that he drew some sort of line back to what had happened in Riyadh by saying, people spoke about this in Riyadh, now look what's happening. So he himself seemed to tie it to whatever may have been said behind the scenes. And Steve Bannon, who at the time was Trump's chief advisor, also claimed that there was a direct link between whatever may have occurred at Riyadh and the subsequent blockade. The blockade has continued, even though the U.S. government has now settled on a view that it needs to be resolved and that this crisis undermines the attempt to rally the Sunni Arab world against Iran, which is now the administration's, I think, main Middle East policy. I think people in the White House initially had obviously diverged from the State and Defense Department point of view. They've now been brought back. State and Defense both were heavily cognizant of the strategic and commercial value of the partnership with Qatar and of the fact that, unlike, say, US-Iran relations. This wasn't a split you could take sides on. They were all US partners of varying degrees. It wasn't as if one side was good, the other side was bad. And since September 2017, that's been the US point of view, that this crisis is a distraction from the need to contain Iran and needs to be resolved. I think the difficulty is that feelings have become embittered on all sides to such an extent that nobody wants to be the one that backs away. And we've seen also with the initial attempts in the spring of 2018 by the White House to try and have a sequential process of reconciliation. It didn't go anywhere, partly because the Saudis and Emiratis completely refused to play ball. So what I think we'll see is this just continuing. We're seeing workarounds where the representatives of the six Gulf states meet in the same room together with U.S., Jordanian, and Egyptian officials. So they have a meeting and just don't call it a Gulf Cooperation Council meeting. So we're seeing workarounds on security, defense, intelligence sharing, which I think just reflect the fact that this is a new normal that everybody's got to get used to, that the Gulf Cooperation Council as we knew it is not dead, but at least on life support. And we've just got to make alternative arrangements as long as it lasts.
Excellent. And you mentioned Iran. Could you also comment on President Trump's withdrawal from the nuclear agreement with Iran, which subsequently followed by heavy sanctions on Iran? Of course, there are a number of questions over the nuclear agreement, as the agreement wasn't really perfect. And this is obviously pushing Iran into the arms of China and Russia. What would this mean for the Middle East regimes generally?
Well, the agreement wasn't perfect, but it was very much, I think, the best option at the time. I think we've seen with Donald Trump that for some reason he has a visceral dislike of his predecessor. And both in domestic and in foreign policy, he has tried to undermine and destroy the two biggest legacies that the Obama administration left behind. Domestically, it's the Health Care Act and the Affordable Care Act. And in foreign policy, it's the Iran deal. Now, with the Affordable Care Act, they failed in Congress by one vote when John McCain famously gave his thumbs down. Although in foreign policy, they succeeded with the withdrawal from the JCPOA with Iran. And one suspects that with Trump, it's personal for some reason. So much of his decision making is personal. That's why it's so unpredictable. And he could easily come out again, as he has done, and say, I want to talk to Iran. He said that in the past. So I think the Gulf leaders and leaders in the Middle East more generally would perhaps do well to treat everything that the Trump administration says with a pinch of salt, because it could change. It's really difficult to predict with this administration what they're going to do next. You saw the threats made against North Korea over the summer of 2017, suddenly followed by the announcement of a summit and very warm statements since, and that could happen to Iran. So it's difficult to see, but of course, Trump has surrounded himself with people like John Bolton, who are extremely hawkish, although again, it's hard to tell who exactly has the ear of the president at any given time, and this seems to shift with the wind. So I think that just continues to be something that leaders in Saudi Arabia and the UAE especially will try and hope to influence, but ultimately, I suspect they may one day just be as blindsided by everyone else when Trump says something completely opposite.
Indeed, everything depends on Trump's mood or a tweet. Iran's relationship with Kuwait, Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates have been tense. However, we do see some sort of cooperation at the same time. The most problematic of these relationships, I actually see Iran-UAE because of the tensions surrounding the islands, which were forcibly occupied by the Iranian regime. Could you comment on the future of Iran's relations with GCC states without considering Iran's relationship with the United States.
Yeah, well, one of the challenges that GCC always faced was coming to a consensus on big issues of regional and foreign policy, partly because they really were matters of national sovereignty that Gulf leaders weren't necessarily prepared to share with each other, but also because there is no consensus, for example, on Iran. As you said, Kuwait, Oman, and Qatar, for various reasons, have had historically less of a confrontational relationship with Iran than, say, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and even within the UAE, Dubai and Abu Dhabi are on different sides on that. Dubai's always been, and Sharjah have always been major trading partners of Iran, whereas Abu Dhabi has now joined with Saudi Arabia and becoming much more hawkish. So there's never been a kind of consensus for Bahrain and for Saudi Arabia. Iran is seen as an internal threat as well as an external one, in the sense that they both have Shia populations that they suspect or have accused in the past of being so-called fifth columnists for Iran, even though the evidence isn't really there. Whereas Oman and Qatar don't have that dynamic, that sectarian dynamic. And Kuwait, the dynamic is rather opposite. You have the Shia communities in Kuwait who are very pro-government, unlike in Bahrain. So there's never been a consensus. The Kuwaitis and Omanis, I think, are looking very carefully at the Qatar blockade, because one of the reasons for blockading Qatar that was given by the Saudis and Emiratis was their relationship with Iran. But in the beginning of 2017, it was the Kuwaitis and the Omanis who actually took the lead in reaching out to the Iranian leadership, to President Rouhani, and then trying to find a way of dialing down GCC-Iran tension. Rouhani went to Kuwait and to Oman in February 2017 to discuss this. So I think the issue of Iran is being watched very, very carefully by Kuwaitis and the Omanis to see if they will come under pressure similar to the one that Qatar came under, to try and conform to a much more hardline Saudi-Abu Dhabi approach, which is also causing tension, I think, in the UAE, precisely because of the fact that you have seven different emirates, which have always had relationships with Iran of varying degrees. But clearly, the Abu Dhabi is now trying to centralize control over the UAE as a federation and to push its kind of hawkish policy. And that hasn't necessarily been the view in Dubai. And then Sharjah also has a very strong economic trading relationship historically with Iran. But as you said, some of the islands have been in occupation since 1971. So there's never been a consensus. And I think this is going to continue and perhaps be magnified by the fact that the GCC is so split. So we'll probably just see states continuing to sort of do their own thing, which is really what they've been doing for the last 40 years anyway.
Exactly. The regimes in the Middle East are not built on the values of the Western world. How the Gulf states have evolved economically and financially over the years, and maybe you can share your views on the role of the religious and tribal politics.
Well, economic development has really been accelerated over the past 30 years and, of course, has been fueled quite literally by oil reserves, which, and in Qatar's case, gas, which I think the problem for Gulf leaders going forward, these reserves are not finite. And soaring domestic energy consumption, for example, is using up more and more energy locally, which means that less oil can be exported. We must remember that the Gulf states do not make their money from extracting oil, they make it from exporting it and selling on international markets. So I think this is, if I was a Saudi policymaker, this would be the sort of one thing that's keeping me up at night, the fact that you have about 3 million barrels of oil per day being used domestically. And as Khalid Al-Faleh, the chairman of Saudi Aramco, now the Minister of Energy, has admitted that nothing changes in terms of trying to diversify energy use or energy sort of production in Saudi Arabia, then by 2030, up to 6 million barrels a day could be used for domestic energy, which means that Saudi Arabia's role as a major exporter will be hugely diminished. Again, doing business in the Gulf and sort of business risk is always complicated by the fact that you do have these tribal influences that continue to run underneath the surface. So you have the sort of veneer of globalization, the veneer of Dubai, for example, Abu Dhabi, Doha being these sort of very sophisticated, hyper-westernized cities on the surface. But then underneath, you have a lot of local politics, which are very unseen, but still heavily influential. And Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and Bahrain as well. I mean, I think there's always been this sort of twin track policy towards globalization, towards embracing the economic aspects of it, but trying to really separate it from political and cultural globalization to sort of keep globalization with a Gulf flavor. And at times of stress, that can cause problems. The example being in 2009, when Dubai World went into difficulties, and the assumption had been in the markets that it would be guaranteed by the government of Dubai, partly because it was a financial instrument owned by the ruler himself. And then the government actually surprised everyone by saying it wasn't going to be guaranteed by them. So this can cause tension at times of stress. And in the future, as oil revenues perhaps begin to deplete, or as economic challenges, labor markets, for example, trying to have enough jobs for Gulf nationals begin to become more urgent, we may see that stress point begin to widen.
I think there are many things that keep Saudis and the rest of the Gulf awake. And this brings us to the future of the oil wealth. Saudi Arabia 2030 vision talks about diversification, social reforms, but it's not really about democratization. It's all about tightening the controls. Government wants to tell what to do, which reforms to make, and where people can go. The young crown prince of Saudi Arabia is a hero to many. He's a good representation of what young population of Saudi Arabia want. And he's opting for a more liberal social environment. Could you comment on his leadership style and perhaps compare to the vision Qatar has?
Well, Mohammed bin Salman is a young 33-year-old. He looks, sounds like many other young people in Saudi Arabia. And a lot of people in Saudi Arabia who are youthful, young, had always, for a long time, I think, had been frustrated by the fact that they're older, that the rulers have become older and older and sort of less detached from them. So he is very popular. I think he now has to deliver. And Vision 2030 was seen as, it was very popular among Saudi youth because they were hoping that this would be the vehicle for them to really get jobs that would be commensurate with their skills and with their ambitions. I think the challenge is that it hasn't really, it's had trouble getting off the ground, sort of accompanying detail, the sort of nitty-gritty, the sort of budgetary, regulatory, legal frameworks that would sort of support it, haven't been as strong or as fast in coming out. And we've already seen a couple of almost scaling back of some of the Vision 2030 initial ambitions. And Mohammed bin Salman has been so outspoken in saying how it will transform the country. But if you talk to many Saudis, they'll say that the vision is really a roadmap. And if we even achieve 10%, we'll be in a better place. And that's true, but that's not necessarily how the vision's being sold, especially internationally. And of course, after the Jamal Khashoggi case, the international investment, which was such a kind of component of attracting people into the country to participate in the vision, might become much more difficult, as we've seen with the all the cancellations to the Future Investment Initiative. So there's going to be problems ahead. And I think the problem for Mohammed bin Salman is if, say, in 5 years, the material conditions for many Saudi youth haven't really improved, if they still can't find a job, for example, if they still feel that they're blocked by vested economic interests, then what happens? Do they lose faith in the system's ability to reform itself? And I think the danger of overpromising is that you underdeliver. I think Mohammed bin Salman's definitely overpromised with what he thinks he can achieve. I mean, Vision 2030 almost takes Saudi Arabia as a blank slate with no existing economic and political obstacles, but that's not the case. And perhaps because it was drafted by Western consultants, that was why it did that. And I think that's going to be perhaps its greatest challenge. Qatar and Bahrain also had their own Vision 2030s. They were actually published about 10 years before the Saudi one, about 2008. Bahrain's obviously has been really overtaken by the Arab Spring, by the uprising in 2011. And Qatar, to some extent, was overtaken by the fact that in 2010, they won the rights to host the World Cup in 2022, which clearly has dominated economic decision-making ever since. And of course, now it had a blockade as well. So, I mean, these visions, I think, are always pieces of paper designed to attract inward investment and to sort of impress foreign business people. But in a sense of actually mapping the vision onto reality, it's perhaps something else. Oman was the first country in the Gulf to have a long-term vision in 1995 when they unveiled Vision 2020. And the interesting thing is it's almost 2020 now. So we can actually judge that vision by its results, and there's almost no comparison. I mean, it's fallen so far short of the initial ambitions. I suspect that this will be the fate of the other visions as well.
Excellent. You mentioned that many cancellations happened to the Future Initiative. Obviously, mega projects like the mega city of Neom City, or as they call Davos in the desert, is a price tag of $350 billion, where Saudi Arabia have established the Public Investment Fund and the strategy of the fund to find the partnerships with foreign investors and joint ventures is now obviously facing big challenges. And yes, number of companies, as you said, they are taking a strong position after the Jamal Khashoggi case. The recent events have raised the political risk premium. How can Saudi Arabia boost the investor confidence? We know the investors like certainty. We have seen $1 billion worth of inward investments last year in Saudi Arabia, yet we've seen $100 billion worth of private funds leaving the kingdom. What are your views on this? Will the companies stick to their current position, or after fostering the relationship with the kingdom for last 30 years, they will abandon the moral factor and they will be there to make a dollar?
Well, I don't think some of the long-standing partners will abandon Saudi Arabia, or they may be urgently looking to seek reassurance that decisions will become more predictable and pragmatic as they were in the past. I think Jamal Khashoggi's death has been such a game changer in terms of what people expected from the leadership. It's been shocking to them. I think that, you know, for the new entrants, the people that were coming for the first time to the Davos in the desert last year, or perhaps are preparing to go for the first time this year, they're the ones who will be put off and deterred in the sense that they didn't know what to expect from Saudi Arabia. Everything they've seen over the past year has almost reinforced the stereotype they may have had about the Saudis. And the sort of conundrum for Mohammed bin Salman is that, you know, he was very successful last October. in trying to sell a very different vision of Saudi Arabia, the first investment initiative. You had the robots, for example. You had the Neom City being unveiled. People left that conference talking about a very different Saudi Arabia than the one they'd imagined. But then just 10 days later, you had the corruption crackdown, which almost reinforced your stereotypes and the fact that they were held in the same hotel where the vision had been launched, or the initiative had been launched, didn't help. So for the newer entrants, that's where probably the sort of cold feet will be hardest. I think the longer term ones will just be really trying to tap up their contacts in the kingdom to sort of seek reassurance that something's going to happen and that Saudi Arabia will become less of a one-man show and perhaps much more like it used to be, where decisions were taken by consensus and almost by committee. And, you know, we're not prone to any one individual.
And can you comment on the financial support and assistance to groups like Muslim Brotherhood and the Hamas movements? How is that shaping the political activities and decision-making across the GCC states?
Well, you have a split in the sense that Saudi Arabia and UAE have declared the Muslim Brotherhood terrorist organization. Bahrain, which is part of the Saudi Emirati alliance in the Gulf, especially against Qatar, on the other hand, you know, tolerates the Brotherhood because they're in parliament and they're actually pro-government. Whereas in Kuwait, the Brotherhood are in parliament but against the government. So there's no, again, like Iran, there's no one consensus. Qatar hosts leadership of Hamas, but they do so with the encouragement of the US, which is, sees it as a very useful alternative to actually have the Hamas leadership there and to have indirect channels of negotiation with them. So there's no one-size-fits-all policy, which I think, again, complicates any attempt by, say, the Saudis or people in Abu Dhabi to try and put things into a straitjacket and to sort of make everyone follow their own lead on these issues.
And to conclude, last two questions. Would elections in GCC states matter? And what is the future of GCC Council?
Well, I mean, you have local elections. You have municipal council elections already. And I think, you know, that's probably as far as it's going to go, in the sense that in Kuwait and Bahrain, you have parliaments and you have elected parliamentarians. But again, the levers of power really continue to be held by governments which are appointed by the emir or the king in Bahrain's case. So I mean, there's always been a tension between elected parliamentarians and appointed governments. And you know, a lot of people in the Gulf look at the Kuwaiti parliament as an example of actually what not to do, in a sense. It kind of slows decision-making down, really creates bottlenecks and obstacles you don't have, say, in Dubai or in Qatar or in Abu Dhabi. So it hasn't necessarily given a very good name to sort of democratization, in the sense of kind of giving people kind of participatory vote. And I think it's going to be the dilemma going forward. How do you balance kind of opening up economically with not necessarily opening up politically at the same speed? And then, yeah, the future of the GCC is that's going to continue as an organization, I suspect. It will be wound up in a blaze of glory or kind of infamy. Yeah, you know, we've seen elsewhere in the Gulf that when organizations become irrelevant, they don't get wound up. They just kind of disappear in the sense that people just stop referring to them. An example would be Petromin, which for a long time was Saudi Arabia's main oil company. And it gradually got eclipsed by Saudi Aramco. It kind of got marginalized in a series of power kind of struggles as well. And it really ceased functioning by the late 1980s, early 1990s. But it wasn't formally wound up until about 2005. It just sort of disappeared. It just ceased to become relevant. And my concern from the GCC is that that's what's going to happen. And we saw the failure of the council meeting last December, the summit, where the same day the summit held, the Saudis and Emiratis announced a bilateral Saudi-Emirati Coordination Council. You know, and I think we're just going to see more of the same. We're going to see a kind of reassertion of bilateral links over the collective GCC sort of mantle. We may still see technocrats meeting across the GCC, perhaps, but as an organization, at least at leadership level, I think it's at least on ice for the foreseeable future. All the Gulf states, all the smaller Gulf states have always been a bit wary of the GCC as kind of Saudi top heavy. And in fact, the secretariat's in Riyadh, for example, there was a long history of Emirati Saudi tensions, in fact, because the UAE thought it was too Saudi centric. And I think the side of Saudi Arabia throwing its power around the region will probably just reinforce some of the skepticism that some of the smaller Gulf states feel. You know, this Mohammed Salman's visit to Kuwait, for example, 2 weeks ago did not go very well. And so I think the GCC, at least for now, is on ice. And my question later, I suppose, is if there's ever a new generation of leaders who are perhaps less strident, you know, then it can perhaps be put back together again. But at least for the immediate future, I think it's probably just a sort of going to be there in the background, but nothing more.
Fantastic. Thank you very much, Christian. To summarize today's discussion, the GCC's allies are trying to encourage greater regional cooperation and integration. However, we haven't seen any success in negotiations. A series of new bilateral initiatives have been launched. And this shows that GCC is more hungry for regional bilateralism than multilateralism. We will be watching closely the GCC's relationships with Iran and Turkey. In order to achieve the safety and security in the region, common grounds will have to emerge and evolve. The failed case of Oman's Vision 2020 strategy will hopefully be taken by the Gulf as a lesson. The future of GCC Council is unclear, but it's all about the balance. Thank you so much. Next week's podcast will be available on the OMFIF channel on Tuesday, so you can download it once it has been broadcast or subscribe to our channel. If you have enjoyed the program, then please stay with us for the next podcast.